Hello, and welcome to episode number 102 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. Seeing the matter of UAP, or as they have been more traditionally been named, UFOs, unidentified flying objects, move through the halls of Congress, apparently towards some kind of official government disclosure, one might assume that what we're dealing with is the rather clear-cut matter of alien beings arising from elsewhere in our vast galaxy, visiting us in their sophisticated nuts-and-bolts spacecraft. Many assume this is the logical starting point based on what we think we know of the frontiers that are yet to be explored by our modern species. However, if one pays close attention, one notices the peculiar matter of the fact that these beings are referred to in official government documentation, specifically in the so-called Schumer Amendment, as quote-unquote non-human intelligence. No mention of the term extraterrestrial or alien can be found. Many have speculated that this is because the nature of these beings is perhaps more exotic than our sci-fi tropes would have us believe. In truth, the exotic nature of this matter of the UFO phenomenon goes far beyond simply the origin and nature of the beings themselves. For if one spends any amount of time studying the nuances of this phenomenon, it becomes clear that some very peculiar goings-on are seemingly baked into the entire enterprise. The term high strangeness has been coined to encapsulate the many aspects that are peculiar, mind-bending, and sometimes even apparently absurd. In fact, the ways experiences with this phenomenon tend to stretch in cognitively uncomfortable ways, our very notions of what we think even can happen in a rational universe, are so frequent and so seemingly impossible that many have wondered if this is telling us that our conventional model of reality is, simply put, just wrong altogether. If these incidents of high strangeness are real, then how can our model be sufficient to account for what can arise in our material universe? And to that point, in light of the bizarre nature of these experiences, is it even accurate to see the stage we traipse upon as a quote-unquote material universe at all? In other words, does the very mind-bending nature of these experiences suggest that perhaps this is exactly where we should look for the locus of reality itself, in mind? And are these events arising from the machinations of our individual minds, a collective mind, or some combination of the two? These are the matters we'll seek to explore in this, the 102nd episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. As we begin this week's episode, I'd just like to point out that if you would like to support my work and gain access not only to this podcast, as well as Liminal Frames and Event Horizon, as well as all of the feature material I create as well, including OTC Squared and various feature series, as well as gaining access to my Discord server and early access and discounts for online courses and retreats, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian or by subscribing on Spotify. All right, jumping into today's material, we're going to be talking about high strangeness as well as synchronicity. What did these different kinds of phenomena tell us about not just the UFO phenomenon and its nature, but also the nature of reality itself? Now, of course, one question that might occur to us here is, what is involved in the quote-unquote phenomenon? This is a tricky question to answer, really, because it partly depends who you talk to. We have seen that there are different kinds of fields of inquiry that are all outside the mainstream that have some overlap. These include so-called hauntology, that's H-A-U-N-T as in haunting, paranormality, and the UFO phenomenon. And as I've mentioned on previous podcasts, those different fields are often distinct and don't overlap, even involving the different researchers not wanting to be associated with the other types of inquiry. But really, the overlap speaks to something fundamental, something about the nature of reality that actually does not just include those three fields, but speaks to the nature of the way things really are. But this gets to my next point, which is that basically, these things get lumped together or put outside of the norm because they don't fit within reductionistic materialism. That is still the ongoing conventional model the mainstream looks towards in terms of trying to make sense of reality. And the truth is, elements that arise in hauntology, general paranormality, and the UFO phenomenon all venture beyond those so-called norms. But again, when you look at this really, really deeply, what it seems to be suggesting is that hauntology, general paranormality, and the UFO phenomenon are not outliers. They are actually within the mix of reality itself. It's just that reductionistic materialism, or as it's more recently been known as physicalism, just is insufficient to account for those data. Therefore, it's insufficient to describe reality itself. So this is wrapped up in our philosophical revolution we're going through, our metaphysical revolution we're going through, in terms of shifting from something like physicalism to a model more like idealism, the notion that reality ultimately is held within mind. Now, speaking of these notions and the peculiarities that we find within not just the UFO phenomenon, but again, in general paranormality and hauntology, what comes up a lot is this term high strangeness. Now, what exactly does this mean? High strangeness is a term often used in paranormal and ufological circles to describe experiences or phenomena that defy conventional explanation and logic. It encompasses a wide range of bizarre occurrences that challenge our understanding of reality. These experiences can include encounters with unidentified flying objects, UFOs, alien abductions, sightings of cryptids, such as Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster, encounters with ghosts or other supernatural entities, and other inexplicable events. What sets high strangeness apart from ordinary paranormal phenomena is the intensity and peculiarity of the experiences reported. Witnesses often describe feelings of profound unease, confusion, or awe during these encounters, as they confront phenomena that seem to defy the laws of nature or conventional scientific understanding. High strangeness encounters can vary widely in their nature and context, but they typically share a few common characteristics. Number one, unpredictability. High strangeness experiences often occur unexpectedly and without warning, leaving witnesses bewildered and uncertain about what they've witnessed. Two, multiplicity of witnesses. In many cases, high strangeness encounters are reported by multiple witnesses, lending credibility to the events despite their extraordinary nature. 3. Lack of rational explanation. Despite efforts to explain them away through conventional means, high strangeness experiences often resist rational explanation, leaving investigators and witnesses grasping for answers. Next, profound impact. Encounters with high strangeness can have a profound and lasting impact on those who experience them, leading to changes in beliefs, behaviors, and even worldviews. Overall, high strangeness represents the fringes of human experience, where the boundaries between the known and the unknown blur, and where conventional explanations often fall short. So that gives you an encapsulation of what high strangeness entails. And again, there's numerous things that were interesting in there. One, for instance, is multiplicity of witnesses. So here we know it can't just be in the heads of the people experiencing it because we have different people experiencing it. So unless we're accounting for some sort of shared delusion, which would be strange in itself, this seems to be grounded in something outside of the minds of the witnesses themselves. Of course, lack of rational explanation doesn't necessarily mean it's not rational. It's just not rational according to how we think about things. Because again, these fall outside the conventional norms. But high strangeness is not unusual within the so-called phenomenon. It's actually baked in. It's a regular player. This is just part of the experience, and this is why it's been so perplexing and why it has remained on the fringes for so long. As I hinted at in the introduction there, we are seeing this matter move through the halls of Congress as people seek to make sense of some of the allegations brought forward by people like David Grush, credible and who have held high positions in intelligence and military circles. They're coming forward and saying these non-human intelligences, these apparently alien beings, are real as are their craft. And in fact, we even have recovered both biologics, bodies, and the craft, and have been studying them, even trying to reverse engineer them for decades. So that matter is moving through Congress. But again, that sounds still like something that fits within our rational understanding, our rational expectations. Again, as I hinted at in the introduction there, this basically fits within the notion that perhaps these are beings coming from elsewhere in our cosmos. That said, it's interesting that people like David Grush, as well as the Congress people who have been briefed and have listened to David Grush and his testimony, they're coming away thinking perhaps these beings are interdimensional in nature. Again, as I've said before, this is just kind of a placeholder, but it points to the fact that they have an exotic origin, an exotic nature to them. But again, the key here is that that's just the beginning. The exotic nature is just the tip of the iceberg. And that's because strange, bizarre, even absurd elements, apparently absurd anyway, are peppered throughout the literature that accounts people's experiences, again, with the so-called UFO phenomenon. And this has led author Nick Redfern to say the following about UFO research. He says, quote, "It's not that it's weird, it's too weird," unquote. And that really gets at it in a nutshell. It's too weird, it's too strange, it's so absurd that surely it can't be true. This has again led to the fact that this topic has continued to remain on the fringes of polite society, because it's just too strange to be taken seriously. Now we're going to get into today why that might be. And again, what it's perhaps saying is that our model of reality is barking up the wrong tree altogether. And until we're willing to get to that level of questioning, that level of metaphysical inquiry, we are unlikely to make much headway, simply because the data will continue to confound us because it does not fit within our conventional expectations according to a physicalist model of reality. Now, some of the material we're going to be drawing from today is from a book titled The Messengers, Owls, Synchronicity, and the UFO Abductee by Mike Cleland. Some of you might be aware that I was recently interviewed by Mike Cleland on his newly relaunched podcast. We had a really fascinating conversation, not just about the phenomenon in general, but our own personal experiences, which have involved plenty of high strangeness. Now, a minute ago, I quoted Nick Redfern and his comment about this being too weird. That's what's so strange about this. What Cleland adds in reflecting on that particular statement by Redfern is the following. He said, quote, "The things that get reported go way beyond the motives of a little scientist in a flying saucer." Nick, meaning Nick Redfern, has also said he feels like he's really onto something in his research when synchronicities begin to invade his life. Unquote. This is part and parcel of the high strangeness. Synchronicity, what is this? We hear about this a lot in these particular circles. What is synchronicity? This term, synchronicity, was originally coined by Carl Jung, the 20th century psychiatrist. It refers to the meaningful coincidence of events that are not causally related, but are somehow connected by their significance to the individual experiencing them. In other words, synchronicity is the occurrence of two or more events that are meaningfully related, but not connected by a direct cause and effect relationship. Jung proposed that synchronistic events hint at the existence of a deeper order or connection beyond the realm of conventional causality, suggesting the presence of a collective unconscious or a larger organizing principle in the universe. For example, someone might think of a long-lost friend and then receive a phone call from that friend moments later, without any prior communication or planning. While there is no direct causal link between the person's thought and the phone call, the meaningful connection between the two events may be perceived as synchronistic. So this is what we mean by synchronicity. And again, what's interesting is that within the high strangeness of the phenomenon, synchronicity is pretty rampant. You could even say that people who look into this phenomenon in a dedicated way inevitably feel like something starts looking back at them, starts interacting with them. This speaks to the synchronistic aspect of events and how they are also tied specifically to the individual. Now, let's give an example. So Carl Jung was the one that coined this term, And he did so because he himself had many of these kind of synchronistic kinds of experiences, and he also saw it regularly occurring with his patients as well. But I'm going to focus on one particular incident that was very synchronistic for Jung, and I think you'll understand why this seems to defy our conventional understanding of how things happen. Carl Jung, the Swiss psychiatrist and psychoanalyst, experienced a profound visionary episode in 1913 while traveling by train. During this journey, he had a series of intense and vivid visions, which he later interpreted as symbolic representations of the turmoil an impending catastrophe that would soon engulf Europe in World War I. In his memoir, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, Jung described the vision as a premonition of a great flood engulfing Europe, with waves reaching as far as the Swiss Alps, his homeland. This flood symbolized the oncoming chaos and destruction of the war. Jung believed that his psyche was tapping into a collective unconscious, a reservoir of shared human experiences and archetypal symbols, which manifested in his vision. The experience deeply affected Jung and influenced his psychological theories, particularly his concept of the collective unconscious and the importance of archetypes in human behavior and culture. He saw the vision as a warning of the impending conflict and as a call to explore the depths of the human psyche in search of meaning and understanding. Now, of course, this is also interesting because it wasn't just deeply symbolic, this notion of a flood, which represented what was going to impact Europe in terms of World War I, but it was also perceived ahead of time. He saw this precognitively before it ever happened. So not only was he tapping into something real, but he was tapping into something from the apparent relative future. Now, of course, here with Jung's experience, nothing to do with the UFO phenomenon is involved. Although, again, Jung was interested in the topic and actually wrote a book about it, actually suggesting perhaps that UFOs were connected to the collective unconscious in some way, some sort of projections from the deep unconscious. But within the UFO phenomenon, synchronicities are rampant. That's the thing. There's something about the fact that it becomes a trigger for these kinds of experiences. It becomes like an initiation kind of experience that increases the level of synchronicities that people begin to notice and experience. Now, longtime listeners to this podcast will recognize the name Bernardo Kastrup. He's a figure who has been a champion of idealism as a model of reality and has played a major role in helping to move our civilization more towards that notion. Now, it's interesting because Bernardo has studied Jung pretty extensively and actually wrote a really great book about Jung. But here we also see an interesting overlap where Bernardo began to have synchronistic experiences that were tied back to Jung. So what happened was, one time Jung was walking along this beach and found this very peculiar kind of stone, and it was shaped very, very strangely, and it seemed to be too symmetrical to have just arisen naturally. And just to check himself, Jung actually walked across the entire beach back and forth several times, trying to see if he could find another one like this. But he could not. It seemed like somehow this particular shape, which again had symbolic meaning, was put in his path as a synchronistic breadcrumb, if you will, that was pointing him in the right direction. Now, what's interesting is when Bernardo was researching Jung's life while preparing to write this book on him, he went to the same town and walked along the same beach and found another one of these stones that resembled the exact shape that Jung had found. And Bernardo took the exact same measures that Jung did. He walked up and down the beach and could not find another one. So not only do you have this strange situation where Jung found a very strangely shaped kind of rock that had rich symbolic meaning, but then so too did Bernardo find just such a rock as well decades later. Again, in both cases, that's very unusual to find it, but they both found one, somehow seemingly because of the connection between the two of them. This is what synchronicity is like, when you have things that happen that seem to defy logic or rationality as we understand the machinations of the cosmos, and yet the fact that this happens and they are so rich in meaning seems to suggest, according to people like Kastrup, as well as people like Jung and Pauli, that this is speaking to the ultimate nature of reality, being based in associations of meaning, and everything else kind of takes a second seat to that. That's what we're going to be exploring today. Now, speaking of Kastrup, one thing he has suggested is that perhaps there are different kinds of beings and different kinds of phenomena within what we often call the UFO phenomenon. So, for instance, when he wrote his paper that was pretty well received within ufology a few months ago, he pointed out that perhaps high strangeness events are distinct from the kinds of phenomena that include the recovery of craft and apparent bodies of supposedly alien beings, or at least non-conventionally human beings. So from his point of view, that is a pretty nuts and bolts affair involving carbon-based life forms and craft that are nuts and bolts that we've recovered. And to him, he's suggesting perhaps that that's a different phenomenon than the high strangeness events. And I think that's a point well taken. We shouldn't assume that they are for sure distinctly different things, but we should also avoid this tendency to want to conflate and collapse for the sake of simplicity. So we have different kinds of encounters that are often included within the UFO phenomenon. Let's discuss a few of them. One of the cases we've covered on this podcast is the case of Yossi Ronin. Very, very interesting case of an Israeli man who was living in Los Angeles. And one day, one night, he was actually having a dream and encountered these very interesting beings. And in the dream, he didn't feel overwhelmed by them. He didn't feel like he was at risk of being harmed by them. He was in a relaxed dream state. Then he proceeded to wake up, hear strange sounds from the front room of his apartment, and came to find that they were also manifesting in physical reality. So he had gone from a dream state to a waking state and encountered these beings. Again, he came to realize they did not mean harm. His initial ontological shock and his initial feeling of fear was based on the fact that they were so unusual. Again, that's a kind of ontological shock. But he came to realize that they meant well, that they were very benevolent, and that key to their nature was the sense that everything was connected. And indeed, this impacted Ronin. This changed him. He began to see that everything was connected in his life as well. Indeed, that everything was connected everywhere, across every time, that the cosmos itself was conscious and interactive. So, for instance, he would go outside and see a tree and have this rich experience of the rich and meaningful symbiotic connection between the tree, the earth, the sun, water, those kinds of things, and himself. And he began to realize how weird it was that we walk around with this sense of the illusion of separation, that we think we're distinct and not connected. And so this was a very transformative experience for him. So this would be one kind of encounter. And again, a cross between dream world and waking world, again, perhaps suggesting that those are not as distinct as we would tend to believe under a physicalist kind of model. Then we have a case that we also covered in one of these podcast episodes where this teenage couple was actually taken on board a craft after their behavior was altered, and they were then subjected to a medical examination. It wasn't painful, but they were kind of in shock by seeing these beings and wondering what was going on. But then afterwards, as they were leaving, this one being that looked a bit like a Michelin man seemed to draw its own soul outside of that body and became a dancing light in front of this couple. And then indeed, this being was able to draw the teenage young man out of his body as well. And they then related as these two dancing spheres of light. And this young man experienced this as a kind of euphoric experience. And he felt no fear, no shame, no darkness, no duplicity at all in this other being. He indeed said in a regression that there's just nothing bad about these kinds of beings. And what you get here in terms of a sense is that it's because they fundamentally understood the interconnected nature of everything, that they are an extension of Source. And so too was he, this young man who had been in the military, that probably was shocked into a very different way of understanding the nature of reality and indeed even his own ultimate nature. So there we have a very interesting case where we do see some of the typical medical examination that is involved in some of the hybridization kind of experiments that are part of the abduction phenomenon. But there also is this element where reality is expanded. Reality conceptions are transcended in the experience. And then we have sort of on the far end of the spectrum, people who are abducted from their homes, are subjected to medical examinations, but specifically in service of some sort of a hybridization program where gametes are extracted and then ultimately they are often introduced to apparently fully physical hybrid children. Now, even here we have elements of high strangeness that come in though. So even though we've just discussed a spectrum of different kinds of encounters, they all involve some degree of high strangeness, even though they are not probably the same kind of encounter with the same kind of being. Again, this is where I think we have to allow for different kinds of origin sources, different kinds of natures to these beings. But nevertheless, in all three of those different kinds of experiences, different kinds of encounters with apparently NHI, we see high strangeness involved, synchronicity often involved as well, which speaks to the fact that it's not these encounters that have some sort of bizarre aspect to them, but that this is just the way reality is. And these particular encounters just seem to, again, actualize or activate this aspect of people and they become more aware of it. So again, perhaps this suggests that maybe even our collective way of seeing, of experiencing the world, of perceiving, which is an evolutionarily derived kind of construct, according to people like Donald Hoffman, perhaps when people have these kinds of experiences, it alters that default enough that it opens them up. And then from then on, they're more aware of, more able to perceive these outlier phenomena that are actually not outliers in reality itself, but rather just outliers in terms of our default evolutionarily derived waking state. That said, while we do see evidence that particular encounters with the UFO phenomenon seem to activate this aspect in people, they become more capable, more likely to have these kinds of synchronistic experiences afterwards, it's not only through these kinds of encounters that this comes online. Again, what people like Kastrup and Jung and Pauly would suggest is that meaning-based associations are central to reality itself, and we just have been unlikely to notice them either because we're so propagandized around the physicalist model or because we just don't pay close attention, and so these things go unrecognized. And because there's kind of a relational dynamic here, a participatory dynamic, if we don't pay attention and respond, then sometimes these things begin to dwindle in occurrence as well. So again, something really interesting is being suggested here about the nature of reality. But again, it's not just via the UFO phenomenon that these kinds of things arise. I'm now going to read an account from a book titled Synchronicity, The Art of Coincidence, Choice, and Unlocking Your Mind. This is by Dr. Kirby Surprise. That's an interesting last name in light of what we're talking about here. Perhaps that's synchronistic in itself. But let me read this account from the book. Quote, "One cool autumn day, I was sitting in my car waiting to pick up a friend. I was listening to the radio to pass the time. During a commercial break, an ad for the movie Carrie was played. The movie is about a teenager who discovers she has the ability to move objects at a distance. I started having fantasies about what it would be like to actually experience moving an object in this way. I had seen the film. During its climax, Carrie uses her power to crush her family's home. I looked across the street and saw an old cottage. Focusing on the house, I fantasized about what being able to move an object that large would be like. I was remembering a National Enquirer headline about a house that supposedly was turned over on its side by some psychic force. I was wondering what effect such a power would have on a person, how it might feel to move a house. As I stared at the house, the entire cottage shuddered violently. The house started to move. It rolled over onto its side. The roof was now facing me. I was astonished and felt panicky. I stared at the overturned house and wondered, could I have really done this? I wondered if this was just a vivid dream. I decided I was awake and the event was real. Okay, I said to myself, if I just did that, then I want to see the house crushed like in the movie. As I stared, awestruck, the house again began to shudder. The roof started to collapse inward as if the center of the house was slowly imploding. Beams burst through walls and windows, shattered as the house began to tear itself apart. A moment later, I saw a flash of yellow paint above the house. Then the largest bulldozer I'd ever seen climbed lazily over the center of the house, crushing the structure into rubble in a few moments. It then started to load the debris into waiting dump trucks. The house had obscured the demolition equipment from sight. With the radio on and windows up, I couldn't hear the tractor engine. My fantasy had come to pass, my wish fulfilled through a series of synchronistic events. Unquote. Now, perhaps after hearing that story, you might think, well, that wasn't synchronistic after all. It turns out there was a rational explanation. There was a bulldozer just tearing down a house, and he just wasn't able to notice that because he had, again, the windows up, couldn't hear things, and his view was obscured, so he couldn't actually see the bulldozer. But it was ultimately the agent of destruction, not his mind. But philosopher Sharon Hewitt Rowlett, who gave a talk at one of the anomalous conferences in New York, has said that we shouldn't be so quick to dismiss this as rational after all, according to the usual dictates of the physicalist model. She would actually argue that we do have synchronistic experiences. They are meaning-driven, but they always take the path of least resistance. At least she's postulating that could be the case. So what that means here is that in a way, both what he wants to manifest is happening, and it's being carried out by means of rational explanation. So in other words, these two are not in opposition of each other. If there is a way for something to come about that looks like it follows the usual dictates, the usual laws of nature, it will happen that way. But there's still an overlap with the meaning-making of this person's mind and what they were intending. So this kind of takes things in a different direction, and it's quite interesting. What she's basically postulating is that there is this kind of underlying self-organizing, meaning-making impulse to the cosmos, and that, again, our intentionality, our minds, our conscious agency plays a role in that, but not in a way that necessarily has to cause seemingly miraculous events. Sometimes things do happen that way, but if there's a way that it can happen where things come together in such a way that the variables play out according to the usual manner of things, then they will. So this is where it's key, because many, many skeptics and debunkers will say there's no clear evidence for something like synchronicity. We can't reproduce it in a lab. Now, partly we'll get into why perhaps we can't reproduce it in a lab, that maybe we're missing variables there that we're not accounting for. But in addition, what she's saying is that, again, we shouldn't assume that synchronistic events are therefore defying the laws of nature as we usually understand them. These matters take the path of least resistance, but they are still ultimately derived from, driven by this self-organizing, meaning-making impulse. And I want to share another story that kind of, again, demonstrates this. Dean Radin has given this account about something he experienced that really was a shock to his system. And that's saying something, of course, because he's probably seen more demonstrable results from parapsychological research than anyone else in the world. But what he recounts is that there was a time where they were looking for a headquarters. They were looking for some space to rent so they could conduct their various experiments to do with psi research. And at the time, the rents in the San Francisco Bay Area were just skyrocketing. So they were driven further and further into the suburbs to try to find office space. They eventually did find office space, and they were setting up shop, and one day he went and looked at the listing of the other businesses in that same office park, and he saw one that had PSI in its name, P-S-I, and he thought, that's strange. Here we are doing PSI research, and this is very fringe. Very few people in the world are studying these things, and here I see a listing for a company doing something with PSI, P-S-I. Maybe they mean PSI in a different way. He wasn't sure. But he decided to go and introduce himself. So he walked down the hall, knocked on the door of this office where this other company was conducting their affairs. And a person opened the door and then looked aghast at Radin and said verbally, "Dean Radin?" in a kind of shocked kind of expression. And Dean Radin thought this was kind of strange behavior. He was about to introduce himself. And even though he's done really cutting edge parapsychological research for decades, he's not necessarily a famous person. The average person on the street doesn't know who he is. So he thought it was strange that this person both looked shocked and said his name out loud before he had a chance to introduce himself. What he then learns is that this person was doing PSI research, but as a business, they were actually looking to find ways that they could bring this to market. But as part of his preparation for this, he had been practicing manifestation. What this means is that he was trying to bring about something in reality by mental intention alone. So he was following this particular practice where he was doing this daily, even actually several times a day, this particular practice around manifestation that arose out of Tibet and Tibetan culture. And what he was actually trying to manifest day after day after day was meeting Dean Radin. So the fascinating conclusion to his experience with this manifestation test was that, yes, indeed, not only did he meet Dean Radin, he manifested that, but in such a way that Dean Radin and his colleagues moved into the office next door. So these two different organizations that were doing Psi research, which was very, very rare in the world, happened to be next door to each other. Now, what's interesting here is that Dean Radin felt suddenly like, do I have no free will? I could have sworn I was going through the motions of actually doing research, looking for office space. Everything seems to line up with me actually bringing this into fruition as just a way of trying to find office space. But he suddenly felt like, no, I'm being dragged across time and space by this person's manifestation where they wanted to meet me. And of course, what I'm getting at here is that according to what Sharon Hewitt-Rollett would say, these are not two. These are not distinct. It's not that one has to be the case and not the other. Again, we think about the path of least resistance. So yes, indeed, Dean Radin and his colleagues were looking for office space. They were able to find office space. But this other person that had this intention to manifest meeting Dean Radin also accomplished this. And the path of least resistance manifested in just this way so that both could be accomplished. Again, an underlying meaning-making impulse of reality that then ends up bringing about the manifestational qualities of what we experience as our waking state lives. Very interesting experience there for Dean Radin and for the person who is trying to manifest him. And I think it's very, very telling about what is the nature of reality that would allow something like that to actually occur. Now, of course, what we're getting at here is that the individual has perhaps much more power than we have thus far recognized in terms of being able to manifest things in physical reality. Indeed, synchronicity seems to, again, be really focused on the individual, that these things are meaningful in relation to the individual's experience of life. Now, if we follow this thread, we might ask ourselves, where might we end up? How might we account for some of these bizarre experiences differently? Let's take, for instance, the experience of Chris Bledsoe. We all know that he's had very interesting experiences his entire life, that apparently he's encountered many different kinds of beings. For instance, we think about his now famous encounter with the so-called lady, who was very benevolent and encouraged him at a time where he was at a very low point in his life. Now, this part about being at a low point in his life is key in light of what we just talked about in terms of the manifestational power that we might have within us. Because what Chris points out is that it was at a very, very dark time in his life where he was most desperate, that he was crying out for help, crying out to God for help specifically, in light of how things had turned so sour in his life. He was a very desperate man, the lowest point of his life, and he was crying out for help. Of course, we're aware of this in biblical history and different religious traditions across the world and across time. We see that certain kinds of encounters with beings often referred to as angels occur when people cry out for help, cry out in desperation. So think again about the energy that's being wielded when you are crying out with a desperate plea for help. And just at that time is when these beings manifest, including in Chris Bledsoe's life. Now, again, it's not that this being, this lady, didn't have relevant information to communicate about the future of the world and changes that the world needed to make, including embracing the divine feminine, which I recently spoke about on the most recent episode of Event Horizon. But it also, again, had to do with his manifestational potential in bringing her into existence. Now, he's not thought about it that way, and most ufologists are not thinking about it that way. The people who look at this as an experience of a Marian apparition are not thinking about it this way. But perhaps we should, in light of what we talked about today. What if both are true? That a being like the lady did have communication to share with our civilization? But again, following this principle of the path of least resistance, that ended up manifesting, coming to being after and partly because Chris Bledsoe had cried out with desperation for help had basically generated this really strong psychic energy that then impacted what ended up occurring and how it occurred and when it occurred. So this is really interesting when we start thinking about these things from this point of view. Now, earlier on, I mentioned Mike Felland in a recent interview I had with him where we talked about some of our own synchronistic experiences. I've also mentioned how Mike wrote this great book titled The Messengers, Owls, Synchronicity, and the UFO Abductee. You'll also remember from earlier in this episode, we talked about the work of Dr. Kirby Surprise and his book, Synchronicity, The Art of Coincidence, Choice, and Unlocking Your Mind. Now, interestingly, while Mike was actually doing research for his book, he actually sought out Dr. Surprise, again, a very interesting name in light of what we're talking about today, and he had a conversation with him, a series of conversations. I'm now going to quote a part of Mike's book, The Messengers, where he recounts having this kind of ongoing dialogue about these matters with Dr. Surprise and what was Dr. Surprise's way of making sense of how these things come about. Quoting from the book, The Messengers, quote, "He," meaning Surprise, "agreed that these synchronistic experiences can have a deeply personal power. The owls are a metaphor of an underlying pattern. There is no fine line between the inner and the external world. The owls and the UFOs resonate with us because they are us." During our conversation, he casually pointed out that owls and UFOs are naturally paired together on a cultural or ancient level. The symbol of the owl is exactly what the UFOs are to us. Here is an excerpt from our phone interview. "Owls are also the classic symbol for the unconscious. Owls are the things that live in the dark, shadowy areas. They pass through the night. They're wise. They're slightly dangerous and creepy. They're messengers. They convey things. They've always been seen as omens and portents. They've always been held as these messengers between the known and the unknown. They are in exactly the same psychological and emotional position in the past for our ancestors, as the UFOs are to us today. They are these mysterious, magical things that we don't quite understand that live in the darkness. They are both generally seen more at night, but when they manifest in the day, it's a big frickin' deal. And they mean something. They are always taken as, wow, that's really something amazing. And symbolically, in every culture, owls are the messengers from the unconscious." Dr. Surprise went on to describe his own ideas on how he can manifest synchronicities in the form of owls, how thoughts and intentions have an effect on reality itself. In his book, he treats this as a playful game. Here, he describes owls from the point of view of his shamanic work. "I make them. They're thought forms," he said. "You build them out of matter and energy, out of emotional energy and mental pattern. You can play with them. They are familiars. They are exactly what every tradition does with spirit animals. You are taking matter and energy from these other planes, that is, in some reflective way, your emotion and thoughts, and creating a technology with it, and then using this technology to change the randomness of events in the environment. And this is a process that is not some big magical Hogwarts thing that you need to learn. This is something that the organism itself does normally. All thought, all emotion produces these forms. All of it produces effects on these planes, and all of it changes the underlying structure of physical reality from the brain. And I think that the extreme manifestations of it, you may occasionally get something physical. You know, lights in the skies." Dr. Surprise had his own run-ins with UFOs, Mike continues, when he was around 20 years old. He described some things that seem consistent with what a lot of other contactees and abductees have said, but his point of view implies a personal responsibility as to the source of the mystery. He feels strongly that he was manifesting these experiences. The UFOs he saw were lights in the nighttime sky, just little dots that would zigzag and wiggle in motions that defied any logical explanation. He would take his friends out into a field at night and say, "Okay, look over there. There's going to be some light showing up." And they did show up as if on command, terrifying his friends. Unquote. Again, very, very interesting. And what he's pointing to here is the manifestational power of human beings. And this being the case, not because human beings are necessarily distinct or unique in this way, but every conscious agent in the cosmos can operate in such a way. And what he's pointing out here is that, again, in light of what we talked about earlier was Sharon Hewitt-Rallet and her notion of the path of least resistance, again, two things can be accomplished at the same time. Somehow there's this underlying organizing principle where these things are brought together and these different conscious agents work together to collapse one reality into existence over another. This is very, very interesting because even what I've been told in communication with some beings that you might consider gray aliens have suggested this kind of nature to reality, that this is how things happen. And this is partly why, in terms of addressing the future and what's going to happen, it is tricky, it is difficult, it's more like a probability cloud, because there are many different conscious agents interacting to collapse one reality, one future into existence over another. And because each of those conscious intentions play a role, they are like micro movements within that organizing principle, it's difficult to know exactly how it's going to play out. And that's where we end up with something more like a probability cloud, which again is being pointed to in our most cutting edge physics in terms of trying to picture how these things actually work in the physical world. So a lot of alignment in terms of different histories, different conceptions, in terms of what's being described here about the ultimate mechanism of reality being this kind of self-organizing, meaning-centric principle. Earlier on, I mentioned that this is difficult to reproduce in a lab. And again, some skeptics, some debunkers would say this can't be true because we can't reproduce it in a lab. But of course, that assumes that we are able to take into account all of the relevant variables in the lab. But that is something we should really call into question in light of what we've talked about today and the power of intention, the degree of intensity involved for the person drawing these things into existence, whether it's this person trying to manifest meeting Dean Radin or it's Chris Bledsoe in desperation crying out for help. Now, speaking to these matters, Dr. Kirby Surprise, in conversation with Mike Sutherland and recorded in Mike's book, talks about the mechanisms behind why this doesn't tend to work well in a lab. Quoting from the book, quote, "Seeing your reflection in the synchronistic experience of a series of coin tosses or dice throws in a laboratory is hard because of the simplicity of the experiment. Only the real world offers the depth and variation of events needed for true work with SE, which stands for synchronistic experiences." He continues, "The meaning of these events is particular to the observer," unquote. So here he's discussing the pure, powerful, intentional properties of a human being, of any conscious agent who's trying to manifest something with strong psychic energy. And it's exactly this degree of strong psychic energy that is not easy to reproduce in a lab because there just isn't the same feeling of import for the people involved in the experiment. So as we draw this episode to a close, we have some very interesting notions to consider moving forward. Again, I think we should resist trying to come up with easy answers. We shouldn't try to assume, therefore, that either this comes down to what we want and what we're manifesting versus what these other beings, these so-called non-human intelligence, want and what they're manifesting. Somehow, all of it is important, again, that the underlying way that reality unfolds is basically the sum total of the conscious action of all these different agents. Again, some of these beings might be further along in understanding that than we are, but we're moving in this direction. And again, what's interesting when we think about these outliers of high strangeness and specifically synchronicity, what this seems to most importantly be pointing to is the nature of reality itself. When we think, for instance, about CE5 or HICE, human-initiated contact experiences or events, again, we think there about the human initiation, the manifestational quality, perhaps, to these events tied to the people who gather together to basically call them into existence. Does this mean that the beings that are piloting these craft that show up are therefore just being summoned by the intention of the human observers, the human conscious agents trying to engage in CE5 or HICE? Not so fast. Again, if we think about Sharon Hewitt-Rallet's notion of following the path of least resistance, their intention, their psychic energy also plays a role, that somehow whatever ultimately ends up collapsing into existence is based on the sum total of these things. and that underlyingly and fundamentally, this is driven by meaningful connections, meaningful associations, in this case, between the agents of humankind and the agents of non-humankind. But again, the key being that both are examples of source consciousness itself expressing its agency. And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian or by subscribing on Spotify. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian signing out.